Good afternoon. It's difficult to follow the act of those who've been before me, and they've spoken about so many of the things that I've been involved with as well over the years. But I do need to disclose, of course, that I have no financial relationships with commercial interests related to this talk, and to say that what you've heard from them is that the whole children's environmental health effort has been tremendously successful in many ways. And in fact, I think that one of the most important lessons in this is that whatever you're concerned about today, even if there appears to be absolutely zero momentum, to be willing to take it on. Because certainly, when I first became involved with this, and I happen to know this is true for Dick, and it's true for Ruth, and it's true for Peggy, and it's true for Insei, that much of what has ensued during that time did not appear to be possible. Not possible at all. And in fact, we were chewing away at things in very small pieces. And so you heard about some of the successes that certainly childhood lead levels and pesticide exposures have reduced, arguably there's farther to go. Secondhand smoke and reduced smoking and exposures to kids has been an enormous victory. Indoor air contamination, the work that Peg and others have been doing, looking at homes, schools, child care facilities, some of the work that the Children's Environmental Health Network is doing. Air pollution, reducing air pollution from burning diesel and coal. The reductions that have occurred in the last 20 years have just been remarkable and an enormous health benefit for children. And not worldwide yet, but in this country, certainly. Much more to do globally in that area. And some of the chemicals that we're concerned about, not only flame retardants, but the chemicals used to make stain repellents, Teflon, some of these persistent chemicals. And in fact, as Ruth said, there's been global action to reduce these. I have to say, not one of these treaties has been affirmed by the U.S. Senate. But despite the lack of participation by the U.S., we now do have in place treaties not only related to tobacco control, control of POPs, control of hazardous waste, control of commerce in very hazardous chemicals and pesticides, a prior informed consent convention. We're not on them, but the rest of the world is moving this forward, and commerce is a funny thing. You can't just do it by yourself. So, and there's also been, and we haven't talked about this much, overdue attention at the Food and Drug Administration to make sure that drugs are not only safe for children, but also effective. And in almost every case where they've looked specifically at children, it's been the case that what was assumed about what was the right dose for children was not the right dose. It was either too much or not enough. It was causing side effects. It wasn't efficacious. The importance of considering children. And that's also, I would argue, continuing to be a global issue. And of course, we're now seeing broader focus on children's health, the work that Dick Jackson and others are doing to look at communities, the kind of opportunities that children have for exercise in their communities, looking broadly at nutrition, the efforts to actually have nutritious meals in schools that Peggy has done and now the federal government is trying to do. People ridicule these efforts. They ridicule these efforts as nanny state efforts. But I would say that these are some of the most important things that we can embark on today in terms of making sure that our children are healthy. So every time there's an effort, and whether there's somebody who owns the product or not, these efforts are met with skepticism. I still am criticized, even though I didn't do it myself. I'd love to take credit for it. I'm criticized for the fact that EPA banned DDT in 1972. Now, in 1972, I wasn't an EPA. I was still a college student. But because at one point in time I was at EPA, people think I did that. And nobody today makes money off of DDT. But there is also an industry that feels that any of this is a threat to them because, after all, if EPA could ban DDT, what would be next? And that it must always be the case that if you're taking such an action, that it's a nanny state action, that it's being done out of emotionality, there isn't a scientific basis for it, it shouldn't have been done, and it's going to lead down the path of more of this happening. That happens to be a way a lot of people where I live, Washington, think. And so we need to embrace, I think, the scientific basis for what's being done. But we also have to recognize those economic forces and deal with them. And we need people to understand how protection of the environment for children is not about being a nanny, but it's about being a partner to parents, a partner to grandparents, to help to make children's lives be such that they can recognize their full potential for health and well-being. So we've had this genetics revolution that we've been living through in the last decade or two, with increasing knowledge about the human genome, sequencing the genome, and now we're able to understand a little bit more about the relative contribution of genetics to health. And I don't know if it's even visible from the room. I'm sorry. I thought we might have a bigger screen in here, and I apologize. But as we've studied twins, we can start to understand the actual contribution of genetics versus environment to our health. And there's some things that are very genetically determined. So at the top we have health, where if identical twins and non-identical twins have nearly the same correlation for height, so that height is a very strongly genetic trait. And right below that on this chart is reading disability, autism. There's a very strong genetic component to autism. But as you move down through this list and look at some of the things near the bottom, at the bottom we have rheumatoid arthritis. We don't know very much about what causes that over the lifespan. Stroke, Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel disease, very important. Breast cancer. Not much of a genetic component to that. Multiple sclerosis, the same. Diabetes, not much of a genetic component. And so we can start to see that the environment, meaning non-genetic factors, plays a major role in disease causation. And we know that some of this is mediated through the actual epigenome, not our genes per se, but how those genes are expressed. And so one of the things that's been interesting now is with the new ability to look not only at our genes and the sequence of our genes, but also whether genes are turned on or off through various mechanisms called methylation, histone modification, other ways of altering the way we read the genes. And you know, this is a very profound thing. Dr. Jackson talked about birth defects. Birth defects are partly due to errors in differentiation of tissue. Tissue differentiation is completely a matter of epigenetics. Your skin cells, your nerve cells have the same genes, but they're expressed differently, which is why they have completely different function. So what do we see when we look at even identical twins and how their genes are expressed? If you may, the pattern of gene expression, in this case looking at methylation. And I think you can see these are two pairs of twins, a 3-year-old pair and a 50-year-old pair. And at the age of 3, the little red dots that you see in both of those are areas where they're different. The genes are being expressed differentially. And even at the age of 3, you see differential gene expression between for this pair. If you look at the bottom graph at the age of 50, there are huge regions where even though the genes are the same, the gene expression is different. And that's due to differences in environment, experience, probably diet, maybe smoking, all kinds of factors between those two individuals. And you can see a quantitation of that in terms of the numbers of differential bands at the age of 3, the age of 50, so that over a life course, the environment is greatly modifying the way we are expressing our genes, if you may. Now, quickly turning also to the issue of cost effectiveness. So, you know, do we always have to be on the side of being against jobs, being against a healthy economy? I don't think so. I think that, and this is a wonderful paper that was published in Prevention and Chronic Disease in 2011, and what they did is they looked through what we know about a number of interventions in terms of the return on investment, how much money is returned per every dollar that's invested in these interventions. Cost-saving interventions are on the left. Those on the right, actually increase costs and worsen health. There actually are interventions that people have used that make health worse. And as the blue ones are the environmental interventions, and they tend to be over toward the left, the ones that are very cost effective. The non-clinical individually directed interventions are in gold, and the clinical interventions are in green. They tend to be on the right. And so I think we can make strong economic arguments that environmental interventions are more cost-effective ways of improving health than clinical or even individually directed prevention efforts. I can't close without talking about the need for toxic chemicals reform. And people know that I've been working on this for a long time, and I've had many opportunities to convey to many people through writing about it, through testifying before Congress, and any platform that I can ever get, the urgent need to reform our toxic chemicals law. We have a law that, you know, to simply put it, does not allow us to have those data gaps filled about the chemicals. We have a law that doesn't allow us to regulate the chemicals to assure that people are safe. And I don't think that we've done well in communicating our message about this to the public, but yet, when there's polling, the public clearly understands that this is a priority, that this needs to be done. There would be overwhelming support to politicians for doing this, both from Republicans and Democrats. There's no doubt of that. And so, you know, why hasn't it been done? We even saw 2 years ago not only groups like the Children's Environmental Health Network, and they've been involved in various coalitions that have supported toxic chemicals reform, but even the chemical industry and EPA, many putting forth principles saying that the Toxic Chemicals Control Act should be reformed, and not necessarily agreeing down to every detail about what ought to be done, but certainly all agreeing that something needed to be done, which is a huge move forward from, you know, when I started getting involved with this, where at one time the chemical industry thought it was the perfect law. They said that in a meeting that I held, so I know they felt that way. But what happened? There were midterm elections 2 years ago. Industry really beat a retreat away from the table. They announced that they would no longer be engaged in discussions about this, and nothing has happened in the last 2 years. And I cannot possibly prognosticate about what's going to happen next week. So, you know, I'm not going to dare to do that. But certainly, who is elected to Congress makes a difference. But I would also say that we as a community need to be more vocal. We need to be clearer about why it needs to be done. I am happy that we make progress on chemicals like BPA and on flame retardants, and I'm profoundly unhappy that we are still doing this one chemical at a time. That is the kind of a battle we will never get across the finish line in terms of what needs to be done to protect people from the risks of chemicals. That, you know, it is just not possible one chemical at a time, one legislature at a time to do it. And so we must do this, obviously. The politics are what they are, but I think we have to be clear and help to get a broader standard, which I'm careful to say here should be health-based. It should be a safety standard for chemicals, not an economic standard as it is today, and it should be protective of children and other vulnerable populations. And with that, I want to close and thank you, and I'm guessing you want us all to come up forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, please. Yes, please say name, your affiliation.
Name and affiliation. You want to?
Mike Leota at the Gilbert School of Public Health in Milwaukee.
Hi.
Hollywood.
Yeah, hi. So one thing that some of us have been involved with that I would invite you to join in with, in addition to the Children's Environmental Health Network, which does a beautiful job actually with communicating, but we've been involved with forming a new scientific society, the International Society for Children's Health and the Environment. And I'm one of the founding members, along with David Ballinger, Bruce Lanfear, and a few others. And really, this is one of the things that we're working on, not only in terms of communicating to the public, but also doing a better job with getting people in various professions that deal with this to be more actively engaged in communicating. Environmental health is a very fragmented field, you know, and so you have people over in toxicology and people over in exposure analysis and people over in epidemiology, and we have hopes of being able to help to kind of embolden those people by making them feel they're a part of something bigger.
Just a quick comment on the data gaps point. It took us 2.5 years to hone down 100 arguments into one sentence, let's fill the data gaps. I'm not suggesting that was the most important thing to do, but it was extraordinarily important to be able to condense our messages into something that people understood immediately. And what worked 30 years ago isn't necessarily what's going to work tomorrow. In fact, it is not going to be what works tomorrow.
One thing that might be a possibility, I don't know exactly the political situation and the policy landscape in Colorado, but in Maryland, when such a thing was underway, a good first step that they were able to get the state of Maryland to do was kind of like a commission that, you know, brought together leaders, some child health leaders, some community leaders, some educators, parents, you know, that to kind of quote-unquote study the problem. And it sounds like a way of just delaying action, but actually it really helped a lot. And what it did is it helped to knit people together around the issue, help them learn more about it, and then, you know, developing some connections, alliances that could be used to then, you know, build forth for more action. And so sometimes something like that could be less frustrating than just keeping on going back to try to get a law that they won't pass, you know. So it's just something worth thinking about.
I was just going to mention that localities can pass notification laws so that when your neighbor applies some pesticides, there's a law that says you have to be notified, as well as in schools when pesticides are applied, or in other kinds of lawns. So that a locality can pass that kind of legislation.
But they cannot toxicity stronger than the industry has set. Which is very important because there are many
yeah.
the horrific erosion of reportage in our country, there are so many fewer reporters covering environmental work, and yet this is inherently interesting. It's inherently interesting to the public, and there are some pushbacks in the other direction. Michelle Levander runs a wonderful group at the Annenberg School where they're training reporters to really understand that, and I think Doug Fisher is there now, who used to be at the Oakland Tribune. But I do think that the efforts by, I think it's the Knight Foundation and other groups, to begin to train journalists and reporters about this is going to become more and more important. I don't quite understand what's going to happen with how horizontal social media and communications become and how we begin to coalesce power around this. In the past, it was pretty easy to find out who the decision makers were. I mean, if you got something on 60 Minutes, you got a lot of action out of it. It's much harder now. It might be interesting in a subsequent discussion just think about how we grow the next generation of reporters and journalists around these issues.
Okay, let's start with you first in the middle here. Yes, then we'll get you next over here.
Hi, I'm Lee Rains. I'm with Global Business. So I had a question about where you go and success is already about engaging with industry and what comes to your So I
Well, I would say that can happen. You can work out collaborative processes. And what I'd say is if you go down that path to make sure that you have very clear understandings about their role, your role, and who's responsible for what and what, you know, what the collaboration really consists of, and that you might want to think about having, you know, a third party involved, somebody who more clearly kind of represents those people, whether it's a labor group or an environmental group or whatever, kind of an NGO kind of thing, because of the fact that you have an interest in your research as well as an interest in doing good. And so you might want to just have that. And if they won't allow that independent other party, then I'd be worried, frankly. So. You don't see it because mostly it's not being done, and so it's a great area to try to think about and move into. But you know, a nanomaterial is not a nanomaterial; it's not a nanomaterial. And we're talking about a very, very complicated array of materials, and we don't have complete information about where they are, what products they're in, and we don't know very much about their fate and transport in the environment, how we're exposed to them, whether they change. Or state, you know, what they do when they're in environmental media. So I think it's a wonderful area for younger scientists to get into. And I think that it's also illustrative of why we need to reform our toxic chemicals law, because, you know, it's a whole slew of new things that have come in the market. Frankly, during the Bush administration, all the agencies determined that they weren't new things, that as long if they had the same chemical formula struck, you know, that the structure didn't matter, the size of the particle didn't matter, you know, and everybody knows that size matters. I mean, if it didn't matter, then why would it be such a miraculous new product for the uses that they have for it, you know? So, but toxicologically, they said it didn't matter. And the Obama administration has done that differently, but there is no real testing that's going on.
At the very beginning, I said that if you know pesticides, you pretty soon have to learn politics. And so many of these issues come down to public policy. And how you communicate them. And it's been a very difficult 10 years. And I think we really have to get together and figure out the best way to attack. If you're worried about the sugar industry, going through the front door may not be the easiest way, but thinking about dietary exposures, thinking about stuff that's coming off the Everglades and the loss of those profoundly beautiful water resources of the Everglades and other areas may be the way to go. Oftentimes, the environmentalists are not always the best friends to the health folks. Oftentimes they are, but how do we figure out how to make coherent agendas so we get some real progress going forward is really critical.
Thank you. And there was another person over here. Was it you? Oh, yes, you, and then in the back, and then Barbara.
Yes, I'm very knowledgeable about occupational knowledge internationally. A lot of the discussion has really highlighted some great success in the U.S., but I'd like to take it back internationally for a second, where a region water works. And one thing that's always striking about this kind of presentation is we're still dealing with almost every one of these issues in almost every country in the world outside of the U.S. and Europe. And with the exception of mercury, which is another, like, we've got one metal that's now on a path, there really isn't any great global action being taken here. And if you look at the UN meeting on non-communicable disease, this whole agenda was not even representative. And then if we look at global health funding, it's grown exponentially in the last decade. None of it, zero of it, is going to environmental health concerns. And I wanted to set out a challenge to the group about how do we take this knowledge base to the global level going forward.
But and Ruth knows more about this than I do. But there is one thing I wanted to mention to this group, which is that this is an area that this group at the Institute of Medicine, I work with the Environmental Health Roundtable, and actually Dick Jackson has served on this as well, has been working on. And we have begun to do a series of seminars on environmental health and sustainability that is really targeted to the global community. And do feel that this is the time to try to bring more attention to this issue. I mean, the global community has started shifting its focus from communicable disease to chronic disease. And I think it's very logical, as the focus shifts to chronic disease, that the environment needs to play a larger role, although certainly pathogens in the environment probably have a lot to do with the communicable disease problem. But anyway, so we are working on that, and I can I'll try to find for anybody who wants afterwards the website, the web link, because we're doing these webinars and we'd like to involve more people in this. It's kind of being done in a collaborative mode, and we're pretty frequently getting people together in webinars in order to explore this.
I think this is a major, major issue, and one of the things that I think we could be more successful at in the health arena is partnering with our colleagues in the environmental arena. I know that WHO continues to try to make partnerships with the United Nations Environment Program, and the United Nations Environment Program actually has a lot of money that is available, but we health people often don't hear about it and don't know how to apply for it, and it's sort of not on our radar screen. So partnerships with UNEP, as well as partnerships with other groups that are looking at longitudinal effects on child health from different lenses. For example, all of the groups that are looking at the effects of maternal deprivation on long-term health, the DOHAD group is a great partner with us in looking at chronic diseases. And so I think we have not adequately explored all of these other groups and teamed up with them to find ways of going forward together to achieve goals that we really have in common. And I would suggest the GEF, the Global Environmental Fund, is one place to look for money.
I was worried about environmental health at CDC under the Bush administration. I've actually seen it eroded further under the Obama administration. I don't see solid leadership in environmental health protection coming out of the CDC leadership in Tom Friedman's office. I'm very frustrated with that. I'm very frustrated that international philanthropists like Bill Gates don't in the least seem to get any of these environmental issues. In some ways, I blame myself that we haven't articulated the importance of this adequately, but it's often hard to get into these arenas and get a proper listen.
And these will be, okay, you're done. So Barbara, and then you here, and these will be our last two questions. Yes.
Well, we're still talking about it, so that's really important. It's been a huge debate. You know, the latest provision that Bloomberg has been putting into place around the 15-ounce sodas, that has had a huge amount of airtime on television, talk shows, you know, with the industry coming in and trying to, you know, influence folks. So it's really created a debate, so I think that's important. I think we'll have to see and evaluate whether it really does reduce obesity in children and adolescents. But it certainly created the discussion. I think some of the other provisions that Mayor Bloomberg has put into place around calorie counts, around for certain level of restaurants or fast food restaurants, as well as banning trans fats. I think I think we've got the scientists here have to work to develop the proper evaluations of those initiatives. But I certainly know that calorie counts make me stop and think when I see those huge muffins they have right outside the door and those huge scones that are like 1,000 calories. I've stopped buying those. And so I hope that, you know, others are doing that as well. When you go to the movies and you see how many calories are in that popcorn, it certainly makes you stop and think and maybe buy the small one instead of the medium one. So I think they're all having a good effect, but we have to evaluate that. And it really has caused a debate and a discussion, which is important.
Although I should point out, and all of what Dick said, so the White House didn't allow FDA to require all movie theaters in the country to put the calorie counts on the popcorn, because that would be the nanny state, you see. So I think it's a huge problem. I mean, so, and I do think that it has come from not science, but, you know, right-wing talk radio, and that these ideas are appealing to people and that we have to come up with different ideas. We have to learn how to communicate a positive approach to what we're trying to do. And that, again, putting the calorie count on the popcorn is about helping parents and grandparents make the right choices about what to get their kids for the movies. It's not about being a nanny, you know, but that hasn't come across, and I think, you know, it's just a very attractive message to a lot of people that it's just governments on our back, and especially in a down economy.
People don't like government until the storm hits.
Well, they like in government now, but only if they were flooded, so.
Well, and I think we're hearing a lot about one message, communication, you know, priority issues, and a lot of us in the children's environmental health, you know, arena are very cognizant of that. I mean, we all have our specific issues. Obviously, children's environmental health can cover everything under the sun, but we can't. We're 6 full-time staff, a couple grad assistants, and some incredible volunteers and consultants. So I think I will certainly take back, though, this whole notion of, you know, really thinking about our communication strategy with the media, with the journalists. There are some fantastic journalists out there, but they're far and few. And again, it's what's sexy. It's, you know, we get calls all the time when there's lead identified in toys and Fisher-Price toys, but obviously We don't want to be reactionary. We want to be, again, preventive. So this is the last question here. Yes. So the question is about partnerships, collaborations, those type of things? For injury.
And the extent to which in your organization,
mm-hmm. Certainly. I mean, I'll just take the EcoHealthy Childcare Program, for example. Again, we have this very intensive, comprehensive, I mean, we could do a week training, but it's a four-hour training. We go around the country. We have trainers sitting with childcare providers. As you can imagine, injury is the biggest issue, you know, in the toddler stage. And, again, 60% of our kids are in some form of childcare away from the home, outside of the home. So this is critical for that community. So while we're in there teaching them some best practices, we're certainly cognizant of, are they even following the current standards, which I will say childcare standards in general for injury are very good. It's just a matter of, are they being imposed and are they being regulated? I mean, they're not getting pop-up visits every day from the childcare licensing. So the onus is really on those owners and those facility managers. So just in that one program alone, that's how we as an organization are, you know, connecting those dots. Now, the broader picture, I think that certainly there are opportunities here for injury and consideration. The bigger point you're raising, too, is the connection of all these silos. You know, the Let's Move campaign, the Let's Move childcare campaign, I'm trying to make the case that in addition to talking about physical activity and the foods and the access to foods, while you're in there, and while you're the first lady, by the way, so everyone wants to be in your program, why don't you also, you know, train your managers and facilitators on also some environmental health best practices. I mean, so injury, I mean, all of these are critical, and this is what's impacting the health and well-being of our kids. And if we look at the cost-benefit analysis, again, unfortunately, if we have to look at mortality or morbidity, we are losing kids daily due to injury. I mean, that's just a huge issue. So thank you for raising that. And I think there's still a lot of work for the coordination there as well. So I know everyone needs to get to other sessions, but I would like you to please join me in thanking this wonderful panel. And please continue to be in touch with any folks or any of us afterwards. And the Children's Environmental Health Network is here for you in any way we can help you out. Thanks.